Succession number 30134, Reel 6.
Okay, so this is Joe Setri, and it's Reel 6. So, Joe, you were just, I think, about to go back to France, were you not?
That is right. And in fact, we embarked, we landed actually on the 25th of June on Juno Beach, which you can see here.
Yes.
There was a bridgehead, of course, shallow one.
Did you, you're pointing to the, there's a place marked here, Courseul.
Yes, Courseul, I think.
Is that pretty much where you landed?
Pretty much, in that area. And we moved to a concentration area, in fact, two concentration areas, finished up in a place called Beni-sur-Mer. We were 4 days altogether in that area. It was hot and sticky. And we were laden because we had 48 hours rations with us, because the transport carrying all the other things would not be with us until a couple of days. They had to be unloaded from their respective boat ships. We were behind the Canadians, who were holding the area, that part of the area. And that is where we were. Sorting ourselves out. We were due to take over, well, we took over, in fact, shortly afterwards, on the 2nd of July, from the 6th King's Own Scottish Border, who were holding a bit of that, that area, that line, that bridgehead. Caen, which it was hoped would be captured very quickly after the landings, was still in German hands. It didn't work out that way. The hard core of the resistance in Caen were the fanatical 12th SS, the Hitlerjugend, Hitler Youth, and they were reckless and fanatical fighters, and as was their commander, Kurt Meyer, who took no prisoners. And Caen just wasn't captured until the 9th of July, which was quite upset our calculations somewhat. Now, before we go on to the actual takeover, I think a description of the countryside would not be amiss. It was quite a contrast from the flat plains of Belgium and northern France, which we're accustomed to. In 1940, it was very close country called Bocage. Small holdings, hedges, trees, woods, visibility, very, very short visibility, and ideal for ambushes, sniping, and in fact, it was, and also mining. So it was very different countryside. Altogether, and very closed in.
Would you say good defensive country, Joe?
Very good defensive country, which the Germans made full use of. Now, our first takeover was from the 6 KOSBs, and the time of our takeover, in fact, just shortly before, and pretty well overlapping with it, they were viciously counterattacked by the Germans. And partly overrun. In fact, when we took over, we found quite a lot of, well, not quite, but a few of their bodies lying there, which we had to bury. In one tank, he even got to within a short distance of brigade headquarters. So it was some time on the night of the 2nd of July before we were actually able to take over, and it was a rather dismal scene. The companies moving up. On foot, of course, to the rendezvous and to take over. We passed a troop for four 17-pounders, which had been rushed up there to assist them, anti-tank guns, to assist them against the Germans, to find that they'd been ambushed by the Germans, destroyed, bodies all over the place. Not, I mean, it's an exaggeration, but I mean, they were here and there, ours and theirs. The troop would be set on fire. Rubber tires were burning, and filthy smell of burning rubber, growing dusk, and altogether a scene of pretty good and flickering flames in the dark. It was a pretty depressing sight.
Yes. You, at this stage, Joe, you were a major.
Yeah, company commander.
With which company?
B Company.
B Company.
Yeah. So, anyway, that was a scene. However, and it was very hard even to find the commanding officer of the six COSBs, because there was a scene of pandemonium and confusion, as one can well understand. And then, as I say, they'd overrun quite a bit of the COSBs, knocking out anti-tank guns and so on. And also there was a vicious mortar fire as well. Mm. And that was a thing which the Germans specialized in particularly, not being all that numerous in guns, field guns. They made ample use of mortars, which are a very simple weapon, basically a tube with a pin in the bottom, and they put the bomb in the right direction up as it comes. Mm-hmm. And very easy to move by man. You don't have to trail it around or hitch it onto something. And they were, they used mortars in great quantity to supplement their lack of artillery. And I once picked up a sketch on the German sketch showing pretty well all the hedgerows and paths, especially where they crossed and so on, all with code names. And they were, you know, once you'd code name got through, and down comes a salvo.
Yes.
So that was the background scene.
Just a thought here, Joe, because you'd gone back to France, you were at Dunkirk, you'd now returned to France, but of course I would imagine the bulk of the people in your company were in France for the first time.
Well, I have a note here to say that when we landed there were about 200 Dunkirk veterans.
Yes, in the total.
In total, yes. Yep. Spread, of course. The commanding officer, Colonel Burden, made a special point to get as many of the old veterans back as possible. Mm. And there were about 200, but, I mean, they were spread about here and there. But for the most of them, it was first time.
Yes. So baptism to fire for a lot of these people, the yep. first time that you get fired upon.
Them. That's right. Well, there again, and that is by the people who had been to Dunkirk, and our commanding officers, before we moved to France, I mean, made such a point of realistic training.
Yes.
Rather than tons of soldiers from sort of total peace to total war. Mm. But anyhow, the point is that things got sorted out, and we took over their positions. Colonel Verdon made quite a few alterations, but couldn't do that really until dawn started. Because it was night and the visibility and everything, again, the confusion that we encountered. So, anyhow, we were much more professional than the KOSBs, who were TA battalion, not as against them, but I mean, we were more professional. And one of the things that the CO insisted on was that there'd be no return of fire unless you saw a target or unless you thought something to shoot at. Mm-hmm. Because the Germans did wander around, letting off rounds here and there and bursts, presumably to draw our own fire, see where our positions were, and then clobber them.
Yes.
So, as I say, we were much more professional in that way. Anyhow, we survived that night, and the following morning, and in fact, we weren't really attacked at all there in the subsequent days. We stayed there until the 10th of July. Basically, there were three companies forward and my own back in some sort of reserve. That is the only depth we had, but it was altogether a rather depressing area, as you can see. Also, of course, and this goes right throughout the campaign, everywhere there was a smell of death.
Yes.
There were bodies, some buried, others well, of course, I couldn't go out and bury people between no man's land. Also, not only that, Normandy is a very rich country, agricultural, and a lot of cattle. And of course, they got in the line of fire, and a lot of dead cattle, bloated, legs up in the air, and you'd get the odd shell which would hit one of them, scattering, putrefying flesh in all directions.
Yes.
So that was a sort of, yeah. And the smell of death was always there, like a putrefaction. But anyhow, one got used to that, and I suppose one didn't really notice it very much living in their condition, but that was the sort of thing. In fact, those were the days when letters were censored. And I know one letter came up with, "Mum, this place is just one vast graveyard."
Yeah.
So that was the sort of thing. Anyway, I'm giving you this background because that was the background of Normandy.
Yeah. Very important.
That was the background of Normandy. Mm. And every building, I mean, this was still being fiercely fought over. Villages, I mean, they didn't exist as entities. I mean, they were just shambles, burnt out buildings, and the sort of stale smell of burning which lingers after the flames, pathetic bundles of household goods and busted furniture and so on. It was all a shambles. It wasn't an intact building.
Yeah.
Also, the odd people that we did come across, local inhabitants, I mean, quite unlike the Bahab, was quite a different couple of it. But they looked at us very sourly.
Yes.
Because we had whatever things they had to endure under the Germans, they at least were able to live. And this invasion destroyed everything.
Well, I suppose, Joe, they'd almost become partly used to the Germans being
they
there.
Did. They did, and in fact, the Germans, not that they treated them exceptionally well, but they made a point of not harassing them too much, realising that, you know, not pushing them too far.
Yes.
And in fact, this is known, I mean, I didn't encounter anything personally, but quite a number of French girls teamed up with Germans.
Yes.
And in fact, I know this happened, but I haven't got no proof or anything. But one German girl was caught dead beside a German on a church tower, having knocked out a couple of tanks.
Yeah. Well, I guess the Germans had been there for three or four years by that time, hadn't they?
Yes. So but then I think they made a point. Also, of course, it was a rich country agriculturally, and whatever demand the Germans made on them, I think there was plenty to go around, carrying milk and that sort of thing, although a lot of other things, of course, were in short supply.
Mm.
So, anyway, that was a sort of background.
Well, then what happens, of course, is that the invasion comes to Normandy, and that disrupts everything. As far as the French people are concerned, there's death and destruction all around.
Absolutely. Well, also, of course, I mean, the agriculture stopped. I mean, everywhere, wheat and so on was waist high, corn was waist high. Everything stopped.
Yes.
So, as I say, they destroyed their rhythm of living, however bad it might have been, you know, because everything stopped.
Yeah.
Not to mention they probably had quite a lot of casualties too amongst themselves, especially in Caen, which was absolutely blasted to hell. So that was it. Now. Yes, of course, we took over. Nobody had any sleep, obviously. I mean, 100% stand to the whole night. But anyhow, we got there, and we established ourselves. And I say we were much more professional about things. And as the time moved on, further alterations were made to our dispositions, which sort of, well, couldn't improve very much, but at least it was much more solid than before. So that was our first takeover. Now here, in order to help things, now this of course is the regimental history.
Yes.
Now I just want to make sure that it's aligned. Yes. I've marked out. This is Sher.
Yes, I see.
There's Caen. Yes. So you see very approximate. We are facing the Germans, and the Germans are holding, obviously, still.
Yes, you're advancing with Kalm to your left, basically.
That's right, yes.
I don't know how many miles that would be, Joe, but...
Well, there's a scale here. I think probably about 8.
8 miles?
Yes.
Yep.
And I think it was from here, must have been, on the, I think, previous to the 8th of July or so, from my slip trench there, I saw 1,000 bomber raid, or near 1,000, on Caen.
On Caen.
Yeah. And that was the prelude to our taking it on the 9th. But the Canadians were due to go in the following morning, and they still met, from the rubble, the fiercest resistance by these 12th SS,
yes,
and other troops there, but they were the hardcore. Well, in some ways, you know, these people, of course, they had probably quite a bit of experience in one way or another, Russia and so on. If you, Caen's a very old place with a lot of cellars. If you get into a cellar, and especially if you can get on a level with the ground outside and shore it up, the more rubble comes on top, you get a better pillbox.
Yes, absolutely.
And so a lot of that happened. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, the rubble created by the bombs, I mean, just made passage virtually impossible. But it took several days of hard fighting to clear the place.
Yeah.
But the 9th of July was taken, or what was left of it.
Yes. And at that stage, you're advancing now, or advancing, moving down...
Holding.
A holding position.
Apart from Bois Halbeau, where we attacked, the whole of our role was holding on to gains already made.
I see.
A lot of patrolling, yes. Mm. Holding on to gains already made. We never made an attack. There were plenty of plans for attack. And these, again, were very wearying, because not so much from the company point of view, but certainly from battalion point of view, headquarters zone, because they all had to be planned in cooperation with your gunners and so on, and involving a lot. It had to be done in detail, only to be cancelled. But then that was the whole thing happening the whole time. So that was another thing that I'm going to come to.
Yes, because I suppose at that stage in the war, there was still a fear that if the Germans had attacked heavily with armour at that stage,
yeah,
and had got through to the sea, there could have been a serious problem there, couldn't there?
There could have been a very serious problem. They didn't take the opportunity which was offered to them by the big storm, which for 3 days held up supplies, including ammunition. And the Germans spent the time there consolidating their positions. If they'd attacked really viciously, I think we could have been in real trouble.
Yes.
But they didn't take 3 days, that storm cut off. I think it was before or after Mulberry, I'm not sure. But anyway, it was a serious interruption to our supplies, including ammunition.
Yes, I think this may be the time when there were two Mulberries, weren't there? There was the one at Aramanche, which was the British one,
yeah,
and there was another one that was controlled on the American beaches,
yeah,
and I think that this storm that you're talking about destroyed the one on the American beaches.
Probably, yes, yes, yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, anyhow, that was, yes, that again, it brings me to another point. I talked about the stench on the general. I think that's
just okay, Joe, so that was a telephone break. You were there talking about storms, I think, in that stage, weren't you?
The storm.
Yeah.
Yes, well, that, as I say, the Germans didn't attack at that time. Maybe didn't have the... Because at the time, of course, the high command and Hitler thought this might be a feint, and they had quite a powerful army at the Pas-de-Calais.
Yes.
And that was, you know, I mean, maybe they didn't have all their eggs in this basket.
Yes.
So, anyhow, whatever, they didn't take the option to attack. They consolidated their positions, and that, of course, was a bonus for us.
Yes.
But again, going back to the conditions we were talking about, and I think it's rather important to go through this before we take our next positions and so on, because it does give a sort of general background of what we were living in, was fatigue. And I think that, apart from this Normandy, I found, from a personal point of view, and I don't think that other people have felt differently, that the greatest single factor was fatigue. and it just numbed everybody, numbed feelings and even fear, because the thing is that you were on the go the whole time. You had very little sleep. There always had to be at least one officer in the company awake at night, and sentries, one alert and awake, and the others could, you know, snatch what sleep they could. And I remember in my case, what little sleep I had one night, I had with a bit of rock sticking in the back of my, you know, that's
yeah.
it. And there was constant this patrolling, and anything like strengthening positions, laying mines or wiring or anything had to be done at night. Constant patrols, just to find out what's in front if necessary, and even longer trying to touch on one or two of these patrols in the moment, not as we go along. But you were doing that the whole time. And also probably getting involved in a possible plan which involved your company. Because eventually, I mean, it would get down to the companies if there was a plan to attack or something, which was then cancelled. That is happening the whole time. Mm. Contingency planning, that's what we called it. Mm. So there was little sleep for absolutely anybody. Little rest.
Yes, I mean, the picture you're painting there, Joe, is that you've got to be sharp and on your toes all the time.
Absolutely. And then the visibility poor and so on. That is why, again, harking back to the training we had, which was hard in between times, realistic, it was the question of not only physical endurance, but mental endurance. Mm. And going leaping right forward to the time when I was wounded, and I realized I was wounded and not dead.
Yes.
Very briefly through my mind went was the thought of clean white sheets, hospital sheets, and sleep, mm. sleep.
Yes.
Although it wasn't quite so bad later on after Normandy.
Mm.
Yet it's still the same. I mean, because the thing, you can't stop, unlike an exercise. You're not going to finish 48 hours.
Yes.
And then you'll rest. Your movements depend on plans that are made and also on the enemy's action. So you're going to keep going, going, going.
And of course, doubly concentrated because of the sort of outfits, battalion that you were with, infantry, Joe,
yeah.
at the sharp end of things.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. So that was it. And we had that weariness again. Constant casualties, not massive, mortar fire, particularly accounted for 75% of our casualties, sniper and others, but those are the principal. As your strength is whittled down, so more devolves on the people that are left. So you have this factor of the most depressing kind of constant smell of putrefaction and intense weariness.
Yes.
And that was a sort of general background, and it really requires, you know, quite a sort of tough mentality, and apart from physical, you know, to go through with this.
Yes, I can imagine that.
So that was that was the essentials. In fact, I think the Normandy campaign was as near as possible that we touched to first war conditions. When you're in the trenches day in, day out, and so on. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, that was that was it. I mean, so such was the sort of danger from snipers, for example, that when we disembarked, and I mean, this was right generally throughout the army, no officers wore any badges of rank.
Yes.
Because it was reckoned that we knew who our officers were, because the snipers would pick them out.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw snipers in dead cadavers in a tree, you know.
Mm.
They were shot down. They were shot, but they were dangling there. Their bodies blackened.
Did the Germans not pick them out, the officers out as well, because they had some clipboard or something?
That again is another thing. No maps.
Yes.
No maps. No maps. No badges of rank. Later on, badges of rank came back later on after Normandy, but not during Normandy.
Yeah.
So that was the conditions. Now I think is that. Now we go on now from here. Now then, again, this was, we were all, as I say, holding things. Now we were next asked, told to move and take up positions in Granville-sur-Odon.
Yes.
Now you see that all sidestepping.
Yes.
It's depend on higher moves, but I mean that is out of the question. I mean, we're not considering those things.
Mm.
Because they're out of their scope here, otherwise you go on forever.
Mm.
But we're concentrating on the battalion.
Yes.
And so we moved down to Granville-sur-Odon, took over from the 4th Welsh. That was about half a mile south of where we were, Granville.
Gotcha. Yep.
That was two companies back, and I was right forward in a crossroads. They called it after my name, in fact, Cetra's Crossroads.
Right.
And ahead was enemy country, of course, heavily mined. To the right was a chateau on the other side of the road, from which smoke could be seen from time to time. And they thought that it was well occupied, and enemy were there, and the Germans were there. Now this place that I took over again, it reinforces what I said, was rather a largish orchard, not all that large, but it had been taken by Germans, fiercely fought over, and by the Cameronians, 15 Scottish, and then moved somewhere else. There were five burnt-out tanks in the area, British, and one Panther tank, mm. German. And this orchard area, with some little outbuildings, was all wrecked, I mean, just walls standing. It was really had, trenches were there, we improved them and so on. A sort of little graveyard.
Yes.
Now, once I saw something bubbling in the ground and sort of moved a bit, and there was a human nose, and eventually a face turned up.
Goodness me.
And again, another place, and that sort of was something odd. It was an arm. And on the sleeve was embroidered Der Führer. It was the first SS. One of their dead.
Really?
Yeah.
But the first one was an English dead, presumably, Joe?
I don't know.
You don't know?
No, I didn't
uncover
the rest. Yeah.
Yes.
Also in the area was what looked like a find, neatly rolled up, a camouflage net. You know, findings is keeping, so that could always be useful.
Mm.
Started unrolling it, and there was a very powerful smell. That was the winding sheet of a British tank officer they wrapped it around.
Oh dear.
That's
yes,
the sort of thing.
Yes.
Also, that morning when we took over, the company command said, look, if you can avoid it, don't put. We had a jeep accompany you, that's nothing more. Put your vehicle there, because we just buried our forward observation officer there this morning.
Yes.
So that was the sort of thing.
Yes.
Well, we were there at Granville-sur-Odon until the 10th. Until 10th, yes. By that time, Caen had fallen.
Mm.
Now, the Oxford Bucks, that's the 1st Battalion Oxford Bucks of our brigade, made an attack on our right, and using my company position as a firm base, so played actually somewhere along here.
Yes.
It's immaterial, really. But
to the east of Granville.
Hmm?
To the east of Granville.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
Well, to Cahiers, actually.
Rather to the west of Granville.
Yes, that's right. They had heavy casualties, and they couldn't get very far. And anyway, that was that. The other thing that we met there the first time was what we called moaning minis. And that was the Naval Werfer. Now, this book, notice, is same.
I can see. Show me a book there.
That's right. Well, now, that was, he was a co-author with this chap.
Yes.
And now, he was the dynamic commanding officer, as I spoke about.
Yes.
Who eventually became brigadier, commanded a brigade of Wessex Division, later on the division. But anyhow, Naval Werfer, which is what we call the moaning mini, was this chap.
Yes, I see.
A six-barreled thing which was electrically fired and made a most ghoulish noise, and then came out as a salvo. That's a naval Werfer.
Like a multi-barreled...
Well, now, of course, that was an early version of what Russians used, the Stalin organ.
Yes.
But it's the same thing. But that's an... it's an aerial weapon, but it's nasty, and, of course, makes a most ghoulish noise, and then comes down, crap.
Yes.
So we met those for the first time, moaning minis. Now, the 16th of July, 59 Div made an attack on our right, and that gave us an opportunity under cover of that, to keep the Germans occupied, to improve our own position, including taking Pepperpot House.
Right.
And in fact, by the time we entered it, what was found right down in the basement were two old ladies. One was the owner, a very dignified person, very elderly, and her long-standing retainer. And that was where the smoke was coming from.
That you mentioned earlier.
That's right.
The smoke coming from
the cooking their meager meal from what they could. And what they said, well, the Germans used to visit this place regularly, and then we kept down below it.